the world. In those days, our scientists typically swept Nobel and other international prizes. Not anymore. The Trump administration's drastic cuts in scientific personnel and budgets will, quote, essentially end America's longstanding role as the world leader in science and innovation, said Toby Smith, a senior vice president at the Association of American Universities. The results are clear. As two economists recently wrote, in cutting-edge scientific research, whereas in 2017 the U.S. led China in 8 categories, by 2023 it led in only one, quantum computing. We sometimes forget how important in ordinary life is government-supported scientific research at university and other laboratories. One study mentions as examples life-saving medicine, commercial agriculture, and virtual communication. Of the 356 new drugs approved over the last decade, 354 received funding from the National Institutes of Health, the world's largest supporter of biomedical research. The smartphone, computers, and highways are other examples. The U.S. economy as a whole greatly benefits. A paper published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas found that government spending on research and development has spurred at least a fifth of U.S. productivity growth since World War II. Yes, government-supported classified research underpins the military-industrial complex. Such spending contrasts with open, science-determined research in the public interest, with the government's role that of a distant funder. The Trump administration has fundamentally changed independent research. It has become the minder of research programs in and outside government, much like a ministry in an authoritarian country. It is now impossible to get federal funding that supports research related to DEI, LGBTQ plus rights, and climate change. Mere mention of those topics in National Science Foundation grant applications, over which DOGE presides, has ruled them out. In that same report by The Guardian, it also found that, quote, at least 1,653 active NSF research grants authorized on their merits have so far been abruptly canceled. Scientists who don't agree with Trump's political agenda are being forced out. At Health and Human Services, for instance, where RFK Jr. has fired immunization scientists who disagree with his vaccination stance. The science program at the Environmental Protection Agency has just been dismantled. Leadership of key public health agencies, such as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and Food and Drug Administration, are in the hands of medical quacks. Karen Fisher, an educational researcher, reports further that, quote, the administration said it would stop underwriting scientific collaboration with overseas partners and stepped up scrutiny of research contracts and other funds to colleges from foreign sources, unquote. Making these determinations is a one-way street. Trump isn't negotiating new terms of collaboration, he's ordering them. For instance, Trump has ordered the U.S. Department of Agriculture to remove references to the climate crisis from its website, blocked the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from publishing scientific information on the threat of bird flu to humans, fired senior leaders at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and cut about 1,000 jobs, with the Texas flood disaster one consequence, fired around 800 people at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, putting critical weather forecasting in a bind, and, as I discussed in last week's commentary, greatly reduced funds for investment in low-carbon technologies, despite the fact that those funds go overwhelmingly to Republican districts. The Guardian offers an example of what happens to politically unacceptable research under Trump. Although climate assessments are mandated to occur every 4 years under legislation passed by Congress in 1990, the Trump administration has axed the online portal holding the reports, which went dark last week. A contract to support this work has also been torn up, and researchers who are working on the next report, due around 2027, have been dismissed. The Guardian was able to provide a copy of the latest assessment, conducted in 2023. It warns that, quote, the effects of human-caused climate change are already far-reaching and worsening across every region of the United States. The assessment calls for rapid and deep reductions in global greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. Such a conclusion is an anathema to a regime that is dedicated to the interests of the fossil fuel industry. America's scientific talent is now for sale. France, Japan, Australia, and the Netherlands are among the countries that are hiring away U.S. scientists. What we are witnessing, in short, is an anti-science, anti-intellectual cleansing that will cause immense harm to public health, the economy, education, and America's reputation. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is James Kemp and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Ross Brown, Simone Perez, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Lisa Loving with KBOO News in Depth.
I'm Lisa Loving, speaking with Chinook Tribal Chair Tony Johnson and Treasurer Rachel Cushman about the winding road their community has traveled to regain their federal tribal recognition, which was rescinded by the George W. Bush administration.
Can we start out by defining terms right now? It might seem obvious to some people, but there's a Chinook Winds Casino, but it's not operated by the Chinook Nation. So what does the word Chinook mean, and what does it mean to be Chinook?
So, to say it, Chinookan speaking people were the indigenous folks from the mouth of the Columbia River up to the Dalles, Oregon. With that said, that is an expansion from the original place where that word existed on the North Shore at the mouth of the Columbia River. It has come to, as you know, Lisa, be used for so many things, right? Our Chinook salmon. The Chinook wind, you know, is its own particular type of wind. The bottom line, though, Chinook, the word means basically at our neighbors. And it's a word that was placed on us probably collaboratively with our Flawomish neighbors, our Lower Chehalis neighbors. So in a sense, that's a word you could say that they referred to us as. We had our own word for ourselves broadly, and also a word for ourselves based on the individual places that we're from.
And going off of that, so what does it mean to be Chinook? So when we're talking about ourselves, we're talking about the Chinook Indian Nation. We're the five westernmost Chinookan-speaking tribes at the mouth of Iga'imuth, the Columbia River, and adjoining seacoasts. We're the Kfatsip and Kathlamet of present-day Oregon, the Wakayakum, Willapaw, and Lower Chinook of what is now Washington State. And for each Chinook person, it's different. It's based on your family, but ultimately it's what it means to be Chinook for me is the place that I call home at the mouth of the Columbia River, our language, our protocols, so our teachings that are passed down from generation to generation, and it means being strong.
I know this is a big question, but somehow in my experience living in Oregon, there's a special regard that white people have for the Lewis and Clark Expedition, as it's called. But people don't know anything about the Chinook Nation. It's almost as if you guys are invisible, but you're not. What is the history of the Chinook Nation? And if you have the time, how do you view Lewis and Clark?
That's an awfully big question. Well, let me just say, and Rachel, I'll look forward to hearing you riff on this one as well. What we aren't is, or shouldn't be, is defined by that Lewis and Clark expedition. To be clear, that was a part of our history. But also to be clear, our history has a time depth of 10,000 years. You know, folks talk about it. Well, there's a term in Native country, especially in the Pacific Northwest. People talk about from time immemorial. Well, my argument would be we don't have such a thing, because in our reality, we have the teaching that talks about the time when it was just animals that went around on our land here like human beings. And we know about the moment in time when things were prepared for and transition happened for human beings to become the human beings on our place. And we know how that happened in all the corners of our land. We know about the details of those moments, the characters. Eat Olipus is coyote. You know, this epic journey that he made from our territory on our Clatsop lands up to the Columbia River and then up the Columbia River. You know, that was putting everything in place for us. And if you really want to talk about, you know, what's our history, who we are, well, we're a product of that and the teachings that come from it. And so when Rachel said earlier, our protocols, our taboos, you know, all of that is defined in these stories and teachings that we've inherited. And so for us, it's our great fortune. I should also say, you know, we had two moments in time where we were in treaty negotiations with the United States. In both cases, we said, no, we will not leave our home. We're staying with the bones of our ancestors. And so Chinook is not federally recognized today because of that decision. And I hope we would make that decision 100 times over. Because by not leaving our place, we maintained a connection to our land that is incredibly important. You know, sovereignty comes from a connection to your land and ancestors, and no one can say that the Chinook Indian Nation is not a sovereign nation.
It's so strange to see these different systems that don't make sense, the political systems in our culture. I just read a great essay in Oregon Humanities Magazine. It was written by Rachel. I was just talking with her about it. One of the best essays I've ever read on these issues. It's on how the tribal recognition system is broken. And I think the Bush administration, if it's true, they cited a lack of documentation between the 1850s and 1920s as a reason for the revocation. Can you talk about how this system, the federal recognition system, is supposed to work? And how is it broken?
Yeah, I can go there. So Tony just referenced our treaty negotiations, right? And we refused to leave. And so that set us up in the system that we are in today. So we stayed. And in every sense of the word, we were federally acknowledged, meaning that we had relationships with the U.S. government. You know, our ancestors went to boarding schools. Three generations of my family went to Indian boarding schools. Only Indians went to boarding schools. You know, we got allotments on reservations. There was several congressional and Supreme Court cases that we are referenced in, that we are named as a nation. And it's a really complicated history. Like, I could spend this whole time just talking about the complicated nature of Chinook's relationship with the U.S. government. You know, our ancestors in the 1890s filed a lawsuit against the federal government for illegally taking our lands. That litigation ended up moving to legislation that they acknowledged they took our lands illegally and paid annuity payments to our community. Our community before the Indian Reorganization Act of the 1930s, we created our first constitution as the Chinook Indian Nation, or the five most Western Chinook and speaking tribes. In the 1920s, we filed many lawsuits against the federal government. And in all sense and purposes, we were federally recognized until the 1960s, when the Department of the Interior decided to cut services to landless tribes. And the only reason why we're named as a landless tribe is because those treaties, the 1851 treaties, went to the Senate, who is the body responsible for ratifying treaties, and tabled them indefinitely, which this is all really complicated. But ultimately, with them taking our land without those treaties being ratified, this is unceded land, and they illegally took it. Fast forward, the 1970s, late 1970s, they created the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, which actually was the branch of research and acknowledgement, which is now the modern day Office of Federal Acknowledgement. We immediately put in an application. We were in that process for 21 years. And during the Clinton administration, the then Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, Kevin Gover, an Indian law expert in good standing, said, hey, Chinook's not getting a fair shake of this. They've been in this process for a long time. So he sent it out for external review by other Indian law experts. They found that we met all of the requirements in the process to be recognized. And I'm sure Tony will go in, you know, to this more in detail as well. His dad was one of the delegation leaders of the Chinook Indian Nation who went to DC to sign those papers. Fast forward 18 months later, a new administration, the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs had no experience in Indian law. The only qualification was that he was an Indian and an engineer from Oklahoma. And he said that Indian law expert had read the evidence wrong. And that's why we're not recognized today. So it's a broken system, and politics got in the way.
And still agitating to regain the federal recognition that was revoked by former President George W. Bush. You recently again were denied an opportunity to regain federal recognition. What happened there?
So, forgive me, I'm going to step us back just for a moment, if you'll indulge it. You know, it was really a great description that Rachel provided of the system, you know, the Office of Federal Acknowledgement system that we participated in. A couple of quick asides. You know, in the 1950s, the Western Oregon Termination Act terminated every tribe in Western Oregon. At the same time, and in the precursor to that, there were conversations in the village where I live and work, Bay Center, Washington, about the very same thing. Termination of our tribe. In the end, it didn't happen in Western Washington. It did happen in Western Oregon, and it was devastating. Fast forward to the 1970s, the tribes that had been terminated in Western Oregon began to, I would say, pull things together and mount the fight to fix that, you know, egregious thing that happened. The first of those tribes to be restored was Siletz. There are, you know, a number since then through the 70s and 80s. What's important for me to say, or for us to say on behalf of Chinook, is that two of our five tribes were terminated in the Western Oregon Termination Act. Three were named. So the Chinook was named erroneously because that is a north shore of the Columbia River tribe, but also, and legitimately, our Clatsop and Kathlamet tribes were named and terminated in that act. Well, we watched our neighbors go through the process of congressional recognition. That is, they were restored by Congress over the course of those decades. Chinook believed the United States when it said that they had created a new, fair, and timely process to recognize tribes. In hindsight, we really should have pursued congressional recognition back then in the 70s and 80s. Instead, as Rachel said, we bought into and participated in a system that was not fair or timely. And the reality is we were recognized under that system. It took a good long time to do it, 21 years to get recognized, 23 to have it reversed, because again, 18 months after it was announced in the Federal Register and an apology was made by the United States, that recognition was rescinded. You know, I wanted to say something. Rachel referenced my dad being amongst the delegation that was there. He was chairman at the time. Well, the United States in January of 2001 brought us back to D.C., apologized profusely for the treatment that the Chinook Indian Nation community has received, and promised us that the building that they were in that moment, the main interior offices, you know, Bureau of Indian Affairs in D.C., they said, this will be your home in Washington from this day forward forever. And it lasted all of 18 months. So in the end, you know, we say the system's broken, but a cynical person would say the system is working as intended.
Intended.
Right?
This might sound like such an obvious question, but what is the problem? What's the holdup? Why is this so hard?
You know, unfortunately, recognition is now a political issue. And, you know, it's political in so many ways. But the bottom line is, and by the way, before I say this, our neighboring tribes, our closest neighboring tribes and relatives support Chinook Indian Nation recognition, no matter what the cost. They are supportive of us, including of the current recognition bill that you were referring to. And I think more than saying we didn't get an opportunity to be recognized with that, what I would tell you, Lisa, is we are in the process of working with our electeds, our delegations in Oregon and Washington to get recognition or restored through Congress. The reality is only Congress can restore our two tribes, the Clatsop and Kashlamet, that were terminated. But I'm going to hand this to Rachel and see what she might want to add.
Yeah, I think that you covered that really well. I was going to say that, you know, only an act of Congress can undo an act of Congress. So regardless of whatever recognition pathway we take and achieve, we still need to have an act of Congress to restore those two nations. And as Tony said, we are working with delegates to get a bill through Congress.
First of all, I'm super curious about what kind of relationship tribal communities have with Republicans, because a lot of people assume Democrats are the ones who support Indigenous communities, but I do not think that's accurate.
When it comes to partisan politics, I mentioned a 10,000-year time depth for our community. We have to operate above partisan politics. Where I live here in Pacific County, it has been deeply blue, and it is now deeply red. The reality is we are not able to be the ones that decide how we're represented. We have a large population, but we don't have a large enough population for that. And the reality is there is, well, I would say both parties have failed us repeatedly. we wrote a letter a day to President Obama and publicized this effort in really profound ways of just pouring our hearts out with the information about our community, why it is we should be recognized, the travesty of having our recognition taken away, and not even an acknowledgement of that effort. The great headache that we have is that we are very rural. We are very poor. Our community broadly, not just the Chinook Indian Nation community, Pacific County where I live is one of the poorest counties in the country. And we don't have the voice. Not so typical, right? The voice of rural and poor folks, and especially poor folks of color, are not heard. I've heard a statement about Washington politics that says, you can see all the votes you need to be a United States Senator from the top of the Space Needle. Is that true? I don't know. But I think you could say something similar in Oregon in terms of where the center of power is. And it makes, no matter how just or real our cause, or no matter how just dramatic the harm is that both Rachel and I could talk about just from our own immediate family experiences, no matter how profound those things are, it is really hard to be heard and to move state politics, let alone national politics. But with that said, we're not going to give up this fight, right? And this fight is not a partisan political fight. Yes, we can all acknowledge when we have leadership in the states or nationally that is doing outrageous things or is that frankly is idiotic. And though we need everybody to reach Chinook justice. And what I would say is ChinookJustice.org is a site that we have established where folks can go and sign a petition, show support, sign up to be in the know. Really encourage folks to jump onto the links to our social media accounts there. Is this true? I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that Chinook has the largest social media presence of any tribe in the Pacific Northwest. We have worked so hard to make that happen and really encouraging your listeners to jump on, sign the petition, and learn more.
What would you say are some of the big issues that are facing your community right now?
There's quite a few issues. We have many people who are living in bad conditions with no running water, no electricity. There's a real struggle. We also are dealing with the loss of our children. So there's the Indian Child Welfare Act that was created to prevent Native kids being taken from Native communities. It doesn't apply to Chinook. Luckily, we've in our local community have been able to build a relationship with DHS and DCYF in Oregon and Washington to have somewhat of a voice, but it's dependent on the judge. It's dependent on the caseworker. And so we lose kids because families are struggling, right? And that's in my own immediate family that I've experienced this. We don't have the resources to help folks who are dealing with housing crises. There's a lot of folks with health issues that we can't support because not all of our tribal citizens qualify for Indian health services, and quite a few people are left without care. It's a crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis is what it is. That's what it's like to be Chinook. There's some of us, I feel very fortunate to be educated, and our community tries to provide educational opportunities through relationships and building agreements with colleges and universities. But I'm one of the lucky few that has been able to succeed, and I'm using that privilege of my socioeconomic status to help the rest of my community.
I was just going to say something we're proud of, which is that we have, for a long time, the largest amount of money that we had in one place was money that we had designated for higher education scholarship. And by the way, when I say higher education, this includes VOC, vocational opportunities, any number of things, right? But we are really proud of that. To add to what Rachel is saying, the difficulty of having all of the historical issues that people are aware of in Native country and having no means of fixing it is unbearable for us, because all of the things, like I said, you imagine or know about from other Native communities are real in our situation. And yet, what I would say is, as an elected leader, one of the worst things about this work is those late night calls, a family in crisis, a person who doesn't have a home, or somebody struggling with suicide, whatever it is. And all we have to offer is our own physical selves, right? The energy that we can muster within our household, or that, like, just my physically going to be present with somebody.
Thank you guys again for being with us.
Hi, Masi.
That was Chinook.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland at 90.7.